The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers.
And from Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth. Your questions answered, your state explored. There are a number of things that make New Hampshire unique. One that doesn't, pizza.
I think we're just about ready to build the perfect pizza.
Give me pizza!
We need two big pizzas, man. Everything on them with water.
White people love pizza, black people love pizza.
Whole lot of water.
Did anyone order me plain cheese?
Hey, pizza.
All right, just wait.
Oh, this is the best pizza in a cup ever. This guy's unbelievable. He ran the old cup of pizza guy out of business.
When it's ready, can you just shove it in my mouth?
Pizza dude's got 30 seconds.
Pizza!
Pizza may be even more American than apple pie. It's the go-to food for game day, parties, and just too tired to make dinner nights. It's one of those foods used for celebration and consolation. Team wins the game, pizza. Team loses, get a pie.
It's also a good draw online, too.
Word of Mouth producer Jimmy Gutierrez.
There's one video of this guy waiting at the DMV. So much respect. Things are taking forever as usual, so he orders himself a pizza. There's another video. These two guys are scrapping on a sidewalk in front of a restaurant, and one of the workers gets right in the middle of them, and he presents them with this pizza peace offering and completely breaks up the fight. Another story is this baby gets access to his dad's smartphone, orders $94 worth of pizza with a takeout app.
Whether it's a soul-sucking waiting line, finding common ground, or just because your baby wants a lot of pie, pizza rules. And it comes to you. Pizza delivery was operating even in small towns across America long before Grubhub or Amazon or other internet inventions.
Like Bitcoin, which the first ever Bitcoin transaction involved... yes, pizza.
To explain, because I forget every time I hear about Bitcoin, it is a digital currency that works without a central bank. Transactions happen directly between users without an intermediary. And it's called cryptocurrency, and it has absolutely taken off over the last decade.
So the story goes, this Florida fellow by the name of Laszlo puts out a call on a Bitcoin forum saying he would pay 10,000 Bitcoins for a couple of pizzas.
Now, this is the early days of the currency, and at the time, those 10,000 units were worth about $40.
I should mention this post goes up on May 18th, 2010, a little past midnight. I don't know why he doesn't order the pizza himself with cash or credit. He just seems determined to make this transaction happen. 4 days later, he posts again, just wanted to report that I successfully traded 10,000 Bitcoins for pizza.
The value of Bitcoin since that 2010 transaction has skyrocketed. There's even a Twitter account dedicated to tracking the price of exactly how much those two pizzas would be worth today.
And we are in the studio right now, Virginia and myself, and we are going to Google search Twitter Bitcoin pizza.
Twitter, Bitcoin pizza. So it has its own Twitter feed?
It has its own Twitter feed. I feel really bad for Laszlo on this one.
Oh my God. The hashtag Bitcoin pizza is worth 89,058,000. Well, I don't even know how to read those numbers. $89,058,149 today.
So, I mean, you know, you're looking at $45 million for a pizza.
So, wait, does this guy actually make this money, or is this just a very sad story that he lost this money?
This is...
could have had.
Well, I mean, and that's the thing with Bitcoin. Like, it doesn't make any sense. But I feel like this account is just based on trolling Laszlo and his two pizzas that today, if he held on to them, could possibly be worth $89 million.
All right. So, pizza is at the heart of... some kind of sideline economy, but definitely at the heart of American culture. And today we're going to spend a little time with pizza, specifically New Hampshire's regional pizza style. The inspiration came from a question we received for our Only in New Hampshire series.
Hello?
This is Matthew Jones from Hudson. He and I share a common beef with the state, a serious lack of great pizza. And I actually just had pizza for lunch.
Oh, I hope it was good.
It was average.
I know how you feel.
He wrote to us with a question about New Hampshire pizza.
I guess it's kind of two questions, really. Why does every town have a house of pizza? And why is every house of pizza almost exclusively the Greek-style pizza?
If you've ever had pizza in New Hampshire, there's a good chance that the pizza that you ate was Greek pizza. You may not have even known it. But if you've lived elsewhere, you probably recognize the difference. Greek pizza is traditionally cooked in a shallow pan, and its crust is kind of chewy like focaccia bread. Too thick to be a thin crust, and too thin to be a deep dish. According to many food writers, one of the problems with Greek pizza is that it's quintessential mediocre pizza, and there's a steep curve to making it great. Matthew's favorite food writer, J. Kenji Lopez-Alt, takes on Greek pizza in an infamous article. In it, he's got this quote that speaks to the universality of the food. Pizza is like sex. Even when it's bad, it's good.
He actually has this other quote. There's a reason that Greek-style pizza isn't more popular nationwide. It's just because it isn't very good. And I hate to be so mean about it, but it's just, you know, kind of the truth.
Matthew's originally from Pittsburgh, PA, and spent a handful of years in New Jersey. But his concern isn't isolated to transplants. Ask people what their favorite pizza place is. You might find, like I have, that there's a lot of indecision. You might get answers like whatever's closest or whoever delivers the latest. So I'm going to get to the bottom of this. Like, why is this, out of all the pizza this region could have adopted, why Greek pizza?
That's great. I'm really happy that someone's kind of looking into this, because you can Google it and there's almost nothing.
To start, I needed to figure out if every town really has a house of pizza. So I went to a man who knows a thing about facts.
Okay, all right, Jimmy, let's talk about pizza here. I'm going to show you how many houses of pizza there actually are in New Hampshire.
This is NHPR's news director, Dan Barrick.
So if you go to the state of New Hampshire's website, there's a place where you can actually search by business name. You can look up any business name in the state. And you can actually do it just by term. So if you go to the site and type in under business name, you want something that contains the phrase house of pizza, and look.
All right, it's searching.
Spinning. It's going to pull up a list that includes 276 business names that include the phrase house of pizza. A lot of these are duplications, like maybe some went out of business or they moved address, but 276, that's a lot of a lot of pizza.
And so how many towns are there in New Hampshire?
There's like 220-ish towns in New Hampshire. So, you know, there's a house of pizza for everyone out there.
Oh my gosh. And how do you feel about Greek pizza?
I'll take it. I mean, it's I'm from New York and it's sort of the similar kind of pizza. It's, you know, I don't know.
You're being very diplomatic.
Yeah,
here.
It's very predictable. But there's some comfort in that too, I think, for some people. You know, if you go into a house of pizza, it's going to be kind of oily. The crust is not going to be too thin, not too thick. It's going to be round. So
it's good for old people.
Kids too.
Kids.
I mean, I've never had a kid turn down a piece of pizza.
But who decided that Greek pizzerias would all be called blank house of pizza, and why?
That's house pizza. House of pizza. House of pizza, pick up delivery.
Mermaid House of Pizza, can I help you?
Hey there, I was just curious, why is it called House of Pizza?
What do you mean?
Because it's made out of pizza.
Because this is the first pizza place since in the beginning of Epsom.
I'm really not too sure. Hold on 1 second.
House of Pizza meat.
It's more like a home type of deal, like come to our house, you know?
Typically, back in the day, House of Pizzas were owned by Greeks.
Yeah, I think typically house of pizzas are like Greek style.
Every town you'll notice has a house of pizza.
I have noticed. Okay, I was really curious.
Well, I'm glad I could help you.
All right, thanks. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
For some clearer answers, I'm going to have to go out of state for this one.
I'm Liz Barrett Foster. I'm an editor with PMQ Pizza Magazine.
No, you're not dreaming. There's a pizza magazine.
I also wrote a book called Pizza, A Slice of American History. It's all about the history of American pizza styles.
Liz says that before understanding how we got to House of Pizzas all over the place, we need a little pizza history. While pizza reverence is in question today, she says that wasn't always the case.
When the Italians came over
around the late 19th century,
it mostly stayed in their neighborhoods and things like that. But then history says that when the soldiers went to Italy, they gained a new appreciation for pizza. And then when they all came back and drove
post-World War II,
they still wanted that flavor. They wanted that pizza. And little did they know that it was already over here.
Before long, pizza ovens gave way to mass pizza production, and soon after, pizza chains started popping up all over the place. Regions had also started defining themselves with their own style of pie. Think about the popular styles you've probably heard of. There's New York style, Chicago deep dish, Detroit and St. Louis style. These are places that were hubs for Italian immigrants back in the day. Pizza distinguishes itself by a bunch of things like crust styles, sauces, how they're cooked. Altogether, Liz says there's close to 30 variations. Which gets us back to what exactly does House of Pizza mean and why are there so many in New Hampshire?
House of Pizza, what we found in that research, is it supposed to be a Greek restaurant. Usually you'll find, amongst other things, like spanakopita and the stuffed olive leaves and things that are Greek, but you find other things too, you know, like Greek pizza and burgers, I mean, all kinds of things, but it's called a House of Pizza.
Okay, so House of Pizza signals a Greek restaurant, which makes some sense since two of the main touchstones for Greek immigrants in the 20th century were Metro New York and Boston. But there were also Italians in these communities already making pizza, really good pizza, like Neapolitan style. So how did Greek pizza become our regional pizza?
The Italians were the ones that were making all the pizza, and then according to that book that we saw, it showed that they ended up selling the pizza to the Greeks.
At the time, Italian families were more established and wanted to move on to full-service restaurants or start new careers altogether.
And after World War II, like 70% of Greek immigrants were running pizzerias. And I have to assume that they renamed them all House of Pizza.
Leaving New Hampshire with lots and lots of Greek pizza. But as someone who I'd call a pizza connoisseur or pizza aficionado, I had one more question. What is your take on Greek pizza?
I mean, when I've had it, it's okay. I mean, it's not really my favorite. I wouldn't, you know, necessarily go seeking it out.
But I want to. I want to find some Greek pizza that puts a Jones in my bones for it. And I know it's not everyone's favorite, but it's clearly working for a lot of people. And then, I found it. I found a House of Pizza with Google and Yelp reviews through the roof. A House of Pizza that's won WMUR's Viewer's Choice Award for Best Pizza the last 3 years in a row.
Let me grab this right here. My name is Tom Castellanos, one of the owners of Tilton House of Pizza. And we're at Tilton House of Pizza in Tilton, New Hampshire.
Katsigiannis' family has been making pizza in Tilton for 20 years. The space feels like a mix between a cafeteria meets a family restaurant. There's a jukebox, arcade area, and hanging off the wall are old photos of New Hampshire landscape and Boston sports teams. Walking in leads you straight to the open kitchen with bar top seating, which is currently secured by a few regulars. Tom tells me what really sets Tilton House of Pizza apart is family.
Yeah, I've got my brother John, who's he's on the sandwich unit. We have our dad out back, who takes care of, you know, the sauces, the cheese, and everything else that needs to be prepped out back. Our mom comes in the morning. She does prepping and helps out herself. And then we have another brother that comes out that helps as well at night. So
he says his typical work week runs anywhere from 70 to 80 hours per week. But for his parents, who immigrated from Greece to Manchester in the 70s, this is everything they could have hoped for.
When they moved to Manchester, went and worked at the mills, like every pretty much Greek immigrant did back in the day, in the shoe textile business, and then, you know, decided that they wanted to do something more appealing. They wanted to get into the pizza business.
They opened up their first pizzeria in Manchester in 1990. At the time, Tom was in high school.
I remember being young, getting out of school, going right to the shop and doing our homework and helping out around the shop and going home and then waking up next day doing it all over again.
They start the day by making dough from scratch. Then it's sauce time and mixing their three cheese blend. every step is supervised by a family member. Today, on one side of Tom is this pizza oven conveyor belt. On the other side, a bunch of naked pies sitting in pans just waiting for toppings. After he dresses them to order, they go into the conveyor oven for about 10 minutes at 500 degrees. Then they're finished off in a brick oven without the pan.
Beautiful. See the cheese nice and melted?
Oh my gosh.
Well, and beautiful.
Those colors are so perfect.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It looks and smells like award-worthy pizza. I asked Tom if there's a stigma attached to the name House of Pizza.
Actually, we take pride in a couple of things. We take pride that we've had those that, you know, we've heard, you know, they said we've driven by you 100 times. Just never thought, we thought that House of Pizza is just a typical House of Pizza. You know, this one person lived in town for about a dozen years before he tried us out, and now he's in here 2 to 3 times a week.
While there are a lot of House of Pizzas in the state, that doesn't mean that there's not great pizza to be had. It's also a pretty solid reminder that New Hampshire's regional pizza isn't just food. It's a story of who we are and where we've come from. All right. So as we've broken down, there are a ton of houses of pizza in New Hampshire. It can be hard to find anything other than Greek pizza. But here we persevered, and we found 3 different styles to taste with the word of mouth crew.
Greek, New York, and Neapolitan.
He made quote
marks. He did the little quoting mark for New York.
Quote mark, air quote New York. Let's start with the coldest, the Neapolitan.
This weighs much too little for a slice of pizza.
Oh, I'm bleeding.
I think we need to.
Hold on, everyone. My finger is bleeding.
And it's got a little char on the bottom of the crust, a little, which makes me very happy.
I like how tomatoey it is. It's true, it's not very cheesy.
I think it's a great flavor. It's a dynamic pizza.
I feel like we're not really experiencing the Neapolitan, that it's like not even warm.
It's got blood all over it.
It's got blood all over it.
I'm really sorry.
Well, we're moving on to the New York style.
This crust is like a stuffed animal. It's so cushy and soft.
There's so much cheese on it.
I feel like I can't even taste the sauce.
I taste more grease even than cheese.
Do you think that pizza is representative of New York pizza?
Heck no.
No. Is this the Greek?
That one?
Yeah.
Well, let's dig into it.
Any biscuity. I mean, it's a really thick crust.
I actually think that was my favorite one.
Greek? The Greek?
Yeah. This one had a pleasant, like, crunchy cheese thing going on.
It's got a little more of a, like, a crispy,
the cheese has got, like, that burnt cheese flavor, and I mean that as positive.
After tasting all the 3 styles, I asked if we were to change New Hampshire's regional pizza, which of these 3 styles should it be?
I'm sticking with Greek. Greek's my jam.
I'm gonna say New York, but New Hampshire has to burn it all down, salt the earth, and start from the beginning again.
I think if I have to vote for a New Hampshire pizza, I'm gonna vote for the New York style, because the Neapolitan doesn't, it feels like it's supposed to be imitating a pizza from elsewhere.
I'm just thinking about all of those 200 plus houses of pizza that would have to sort of redo their whole thing, and it's just too much for me to comprehend.
Can't New Hampshire pizza just be a pizza in which we replace the tomato sauce with maple syrup?
That was Jimmy Gutierrez with producers Hannah McCarthy, Nick Capodice, Taylor Quimby, executive producer Erica Janik, Sam Evans-Brown, and me, taste testing the most popular varieties from New Hampshire's pizza scene. We'd like to hear about your go-to pizza in New Hampshire, House of Pizza or otherwise. Leave us a message with your name, the name of the place that makes your preferred pie, and why you love it at 603-513-7796. At 603-513-7796. Or post your pics on our Facebook page or on Twitter at Word of Mouth, and we'll be sure to share it on the show. So call us. Pizza is so much better when it's shared. Up next, from the history of the state's pizza scene to a look at education and activism in the antebellum Northeast, how African American women led the fight for school access in the 19th century. That's when Word of Mouth continues. After a short break, here on NHPR. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Northern states have long sought to distance themselves from the racism characteristic of the South's political and social history. But for African Americans living in the Northeast, access to economic and educational opportunity has come in fits and starts. We're going to learn about some of the steps forward taken by some extraordinary 19th century women with Cabrilla Baumgartner. She's assistant professor of American Studies at the University of New Hampshire, and she's in the process of writing her first book called A Right to Learn, African American Women and Educational Activism in Antebellum America. Cabrilla, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
This book covers the period from 1820 to 1860. Why that time in particular?
There are quite a few studies on African American education in the 20th century, but there is less that we know about African-American education, and particularly African-American women in the 19th century. And so I chose to explore this interesting period and to place African-American women sort of in that period.
So what was life like for African-Americans in general living in the Northeast in those years? Now, this is leading up to the Civil War.
I would describe that time period as a turbulent time for African-Americans. And I would actually say that the North was also turbulent. On the one hand, the North was a land of freedom, especially compared to the slaveholding South. But on the other hand, the North was quite brutal for African Americans who faced social, political, and legal discrimination, not to mention limited opportunities in education and in employment and other facets of their life.
So were African-American children attending schools in the Northeast at that time?
So yeah, there are some examples of African-American children attending common schools in the Northeast. One of the things I realized as I've been working on this project is that it's really dependent on sort of local municipalities. So in some areas, African-American children will be able to attend common schools. Most likely those schools will be segregated. In other towns and cities, African Americans might be excluded altogether.
What is a common school?
A common school is basically the precursor to our public schools today. These are schools that are free, tax supported, and open ostensibly to all children, although we know in the 19th century, not all children were able to attend.
This book focuses on private female seminaries and public schools and educational campaigns launched by women. Were these women organized or were they unified in this strategy to educate African Americans, or were these individuals operating on their own?
I think for the most part, these were individuals operating on their own, at least initially. So in the 1820s and 1830s, with a person like Prudence Crandall, this white Quaker woman who opened up a seminary for African-American women in Connecticut, she kind of did that on her own. She had encouragement, actually, from a young African-American woman who was living in the village where her school was operating. So that student came to her and said, I want to attend your seminary. Can I? And Prudence Crandall thought about it and finally said, yes, you can. So sometimes it's happenstance. Circumstance that just makes it happen. In other cases, especially in the 1840s and 1850s, it becomes more unified, especially when you get the Equal Rights Campaign or the campaign to abolish racial segregation in public schools. That is definitely organized, and that is definitely a unified effort.
Tell us more about that, this campaign for equal rights in the 19th century?
Absolutely. So you had African-American parents, African-American teachers and students and community leaders who fought for their educational rights. They submitted petitions to local school committees and to state legislatures, and they even boycotted segregated common schools. In the 1840s and 1850s, in Massachusetts and Rhode Island, you have African-American activists there who initiate this campaign for equal school rights, as they called it. And it took many years of activism, but eventually it led to Massachusetts desegregating its common schools in 1855, and then Rhode Island desegregating its common schools in 1866.
Well, so often when we think of education or public education, we're, of course, thinking about children. But I imagine that there must have been a huge population of adults, African-American adults and white adults, for that matter, who were not able to read or be educated. Was there an attempt to educate adults at this time?
Absolutely. There was an effort in the early 1830s in Connecticut to open a manual labor college for African-American men. And this effort was supported, of course, by African-American activists, but also by white allies. So folks like William Lloyd Garrison, the sort of prominent white abolitionists. And unfortunately, there was so much pushback from the town of New Haven, where this college would be located, that the local residents there voted against the proposal to establish this manual labor college in New Haven. So given that, what we can see in New England is that it's very difficult for African Americans, both children and adults, to really obtain an education.
So some of the women that you write about, there are just a fascinating bunch. Some of them, African-American, Sarah Mapp Douglas, I think of, was it Serena DeGrasse Downing?
Yes.
Really interesting. Some former domestic servants who were of European descent, some abolitionists, as you mentioned. But they come up with some interesting strategies outside of the public school model to educate people. What were some of those strategies?
Right. So African Americans oftentimes relied on their own community institutions and their own private organizations to get an education and to learn. So you might have African American women like Serena DeGrasse, who participated in a New York Women's Literary Society for African American women. And in these literary societies, there would be political discussions, social discussions, about a whole range of issues, about the discrimination African Americans faced, or about the importance of gaining knowledge. There would be some kind of discussion at the heart of those meetings. So that really became a space, an important educational space for African American women. And you had literary societies in New York City, in Boston, in the Midwest, in Ohio, where African American women were talking and discussing social and political issues.
How about here in New Hampshire? You mentioned Boston and Nantucket. What was going on here at the time?
New Hampshire is a really interesting state. And when I was working on this book, I didn't really expect to find that much information about New Hampshire, mostly because the African-American population is so small. But one of the things I did find is that there were some desegregated, or what you might call integrated, common schools in New Hampshire towns. So an example would be Exeter. Their public schools were integrated, and we have records of African-American children going to school there. But for the most part, in New Hampshire, race relations are fairly tense. There's an example in 1835 of a coeducational and interracial school, it's called Noyes Academy, that was actually attacked by a mob. And this mob made it known that they despised the presence of African-American youth in that town.
Hmm.
And so they destroyed the school.
There is a woman who you profile in the book. Her name is Rosetta Morrison. Now, she was a servant for a white family in Exeter. What was her role in pushing for education for African-Americans?
Rosetta Morrison is really a fascinating woman, and I kind of discovered her by chance. She was born in 1818 in Connecticut, and I think she may have been orphaned probably around the age of 8 years old or 9 years old, because that's when she's hired to work as a servant. And she's from Connecticut, probably born in Hartford, but she moves to Exeter, New Hampshire, to work for this family, the Rowland family in Exeter, New Hampshire, which is a fairly prominent white family. It seems that Rosetta was very much part of the family. The family seemed to take a liking to her, and they sought to educate her, and they did. And finally, I guess when her service had ended, around 20 years old, she actually enrolls and attends one of the first integrated, racially integrated female seminaries in upstate New York.
Hmm.
And that's pretty incredible, given her earlier life, that she actually has this opportunity.
And then she goes on to open a school in New York City for African-American children.
That's right. That's right. It's a short-lived school, but it's important because you see how much education factored into her life and how important it was for her to give back to her community and to educate African-American children. The school stays open about 6 to 8 months, and then she gets married. And so it's not unusual in the 19th century for a female teacher to get married and to quit teaching. Mm-hmm. And that's what Rosetta does. So she raises her family, and she marries, though, a fugitive slave. And he's constantly on the run, and that creates a lot of difficulty and a lot of stress on her family. So later on in life, about 40 years old, Rosetta actually has to go back to work. But the question is, what is she going to do? She is highly educated, but the teaching profession isn't really open to her anymore. So she ends up working for 10 years as a washerwoman. And a washerwoman is basically a woman who washes clothes. And so it's an occupation that attracts a lot of poor and working class African-American women. And I think that underscores the point that there was opportunity that Rosetta had when she attended this female seminary, but there are these sort of larger structures that really made it difficult for her to live her life and for her family to live their life, right? So we get the passage of the Fugitive Slave Law in 1850, and that makes it increasingly difficult for Isaac to live in the North. So despite this great opportunity she had, it doesn't really mean anything sometimes when there are larger structures in place that make it difficult for one to live. But in the book, I'm arguing that she did leave a legacy through her children. So she had 4 daughters, and all of her daughters became public school teachers in New York City.
Cabrera, you're a professor now at UNH, and last year we did look into treatment of students of color on campus who charged that the mm-hmm. university administration has for decades fallen short on its commitment to students of color. What do you think? You know, you've been looking at how women, pioneers in education, changed the game. What do you think looking at the campus that you work with now?
I think there are a lot of positive and encouraging initiatives at UNH. But the issue of educational equality is an issue that we're fighting sort of as a nation. So whether it's early childhood education or higher education, there's still inequality that exists. I think in some ways the Equal School Rights campaign that African Americans led in the 19th century is still being fought today. We still have issues around unequal funding. We still have issues around professionalization. We have issues around representation. But I think what's interesting about this book and about this project is that there is a usable past here. African American activists in the 19th century organized, petitioned, boycotted, they wrote op-eds, they filed lawsuits, they even ran for office. There are so many forms of activism that they engaged in, and I think that activism is necessary today, and I do think it's happening today.
Cabrera, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Cabrera Baumgartner, Assistant Professor of American Studies at the University of New Hampshire, currently writing her first book, A Right to Learn, African American Women and Educational Activism in Antebellum America. You can find a link to her work at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And stay with us for a cigar-smoking, saloon-brawling stagecoach driver in America's Wild West, Mary Fields. Yep, a woman. And an African American. Just one of the stories you didn't hear about in school, but should have. Joel Christian Gill shares some doozies after the break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. You've probably heard of Martin, Malcolm, and Rosa, but how about Eugene Ballard, a second-class citizen at home, but a hero abroad, or the pianist known as Blind Tom Wiggins, born into slavery, but played concert stages all over the world. We're listening to his composition and take on the battle hymn of the Republic, The Battle of Manassas. These are just two African Americans rescued from obscurity in the second volume in the Strange Fruit comic book anthology. It's a series of uncelebrated narratives from Black history. Joel Christian Gill creates the comics. He's also chair of foundations at the New Hampshire Institute of Art in Manchester. And Joel, great to have you back with us.
Thanks for having me back. It's good to be here.
So in the foreword to your newest volume, it refers to stories that African Americans have told for generations through oral traditions, told and retold in families. So how do you find them?
It's funny because, you know, once you do one, it's almost like the rest of it, like the floodgates open up and people start telling you about other ones. I don't think I've ever been at an event where somebody hasn't told me about some new, you know, story about from their area about Black history. And it's amazing because it's like I don't have to do the research. People just like tell me these stories and then I can go out and look at them and nobody's ever heard about them. So that becomes the hard part, is because no one's heard about these stories. And so now I have to go find stuff that people haven't talked about and written about. So it becomes a real, real hard digging process. But my editors are great, so they help me.
So a lot of these people were, you know, private citizens, pretty well hidden, but some led very public lives, like Blind Tom Wiggins. Now, we just heard one of his compositions. Who was he?
So Blind Tom Wiggins was an autistic musical savant. He was born a slave, and they didn't expect him to survive because he couldn't see, and they didn't know much about it. They thought he was going to die. So he was thrown in free with his parents when he was bought. And pretty soon they learned that he was a musical genius. There's a really famous thing where he's listening to, and I draw about this in the book, and he's listening to one of the slave master's children play this song over and over, and she's failing. And in the story, he pushes her off the seat and goes, "You was doing it wrong," and just completely plays it automatically. And he's 4 or 5 years old. You know, that's the progression. And once they figure out he's got this talent, they send him off to perform for the Confederacy. And of course, Tom doesn't know that he's doing this for the Confederacy because he couldn't read or write. He couldn't see. He couldn't feed himself. He could only play music. And it was the thing that he loved to do. So Tom goes through his entire life just playing music and wanting to play music while also helping the Confederacy. But when he's freed, he becomes known as the last American slave because of this draconian contract that his parents signed for him. And there was a court battle, and Tom made a lot of money for his former owner and his owner's stepchildren and in-laws. And he ended up the rest of his days with the in-laws of his former owner. And, you know, he was pretty mistreated, and all he wanted to do was play music his entire life.
So he was a man born a slave. So was Jordan Anderson, but he was freed after the Civil War. In Strange Fruit, we see this letter that he wrote to Colonel Anderson. This is a man who owned him before emancipation. In it, he asks him for $11,680. What for?
Yeah, so the most amazing clapback in history, right? his master sends him this letter, and he says, you know, "Come and help us. Come back to the farm. We'll treat you good." And Jordan Anderson's like, "Yeah, probably not. And maybe, but if you send me $11,680 for, you know, the back wages that you owe me and my wife, minus food and clothes and some medical expenses, then I'll take that as good faith and maybe even consider coming back and working for you," which is absolutely amazing. And it's also one of those things that slaves did. They couldn't aggressively come out against racism and white supremacy. And so they had to do it with dry humor and wit. At the end of the book, he goes, "And thank Tom for, you know, taking that gun away from you so you wouldn't shoot me." You know what I mean? There's these things that they couldn't do, but they could sneak it in this backhanded way, which is just brilliant.
One of the women who does leave the South is Stagecoach Mary Fields, a strong woman with a very commanding presence.
I mean, there's a lot of stuff that I did not even write about Stagecoach Mary Fields, you know, how much she drank and how she smoked cigars and she carried pistols and she always had a dog with her. They called her Shotgun Mary at certain points. But she was this 60-year-old woman who at 60 years old won a star route for the U.S. Postal Service. And a star route for the U.S. Postal Service was the most dangerous routes. And so this route was in northern Montana that she would have to ride this 100-mile route in the wintertime. And she did it by being the fastest person to rig horses and buggies together, six horses to a buggy. And she did it at age 60 against men that were half her age. She was amazing. And like the town would throw like a party for her on her birthday. Like she had special dispensation from the mayor to drink in the bars because women weren't allowed to drink and she could drink in the bars. And I think one of my favorite things is that they had signs up in the bars that says, if you could take a punch from Black Mary, then you'll get $5. And nobody ever was able to collect the $5 because she would just knock people out. She was amazing. She was incredible.
Well, and she's a wanderer. And there are a lot of stories of wanderers here. You know, people moving from place to place, a few ending up in the American West, where they found some level of independence and, like Stagecoach Mary, recognition. Was that common to the African-American experience?
Most people don't know this, and I think most people don't realize this, but when you watch Westerns, they are almost always a single set of historical facts because most cowboys and people in the Old West settlers were people of color. They were Native Americans or they were Black, and then one-third of them were white. Most people don't know that. Just another statistic that's really interesting is that And right after Reconstruction, there were 150 all-Black towns in Oklahoma. Most people don't know that. Like, most people don't, like, have no real conception that there were, like, these Black towns. Because Black people were leaving the racism and the oppression that they had in other places and basically starting out on their own. And, you know, so, like, when you look at Westerns and you see that, and I wrote about Willie Kennard, who was a sheriff who just kind of wandered out into the West, and he ends up in Colorado in this now defunct town called Yankee Hill and basically saves the town. He like comes in, they need a sheriff and they don't believe that he can even read, and they give him a badge and he basically saves the town and then disappears. He vanishes, which is like the classic Old West story. Right.
He's the stranger who rolls in on horseback. He's even wearing a serape, I think. In the book.
That was my homage to Clint Eastwood in that one. And he like comes in and he just saves the town. And he's like, you know, it's like an amazing story that should be a story at some point. We should, you know, if anybody's listening, we should make movies about all of these things.
Well, the journalist in me wants to know about Prove, because you call it the true story of lawman Willie Kennard. How do you verify stories like this?
So looking up the history of some of those people is really difficult, but I always try to use primary sources, like newspaper events where people have said those things, because if you look at the things that happen after the fact, it gets sort of embellished. So I try to find the things that people said about those people. So it's all like digging. It's finding old newspaper articles. It's finding like any reference that you can to those people. There's some evidence that Willie Kennard, for example, went on to become the bodyguard to Barney Ford, who was known as the Baron of Colorado. He was like the richest Black man in Colorado. So, you know, it's all about digging and digging and digging and trying to find primary sources of people who nobody wanted to talk about, which is really difficult, which is why it takes so long to do some of those
stories. Well, and I also noticed that often the stories just drop off. You know, like there's no more written history of them. They're just gone.
Yeah, that's exactly what happens. Like with Jordan Anderson, no more history about him.
Right. We don't know if he ever got his 11,000.
No, we don't know if he got his 11,600. That's what my mom said. She read the story. She's like, she puts the book down. She goes, Joel, did he get the money? It's like, I don't know, Mama. I think he might have. I'm not going to lay
a bet on that one. How about photographs? I mean, a lot of them 19th century. Any surviving photographs that you used for creating these images, or do you just cook them?
Yeah, there's some photographs of Stagecoach Mary. There's one with her with baseball teams because she was really in love with baseball. There's a lot of French photographs. There's actually a place in Paris where you go. There's a museum for the people who run the Croix de Guerre, which is like the French Medal of Honor.
Yeah.
And there's a museum. So you can go to that museum and they actually have a whole display about Eugene Boulard. So there's some pictures of him. There's a lot of pictures of him. But like with Willie Kennard, you just have to guess of like, I think there is one picture of Cathay Williams, but it's her as an old lady. So she's really old and feeble at the time. So you have to like deconstruct what an old lady would look like versus her. So most of the time when I'm doing these stories, it's almost like trying to draw a composite image of what it would have looked like. They wouldn't have wore this color. They wouldn't have wore that color. Mm-hmm. That everything would have been brown or dark. You know, they wouldn't have wore bright colors and they wouldn't have had the latest fashion. So what would that have looked like? And so it's like when I remember when I was drawing Jordan Anderson's children, I just found like a lot of pictures of slave children and sort of composited all of those images together in order to get something that looked like it might be correct.
Well, you're writing about African-American history. It's actually American history. And this is, you know, representation is such a big conversation on so many fronts. And I'm noticing all kinds of excitement for the Black Panther film, which opened this weekend.
I have my Black Panther shirt on right now.
He does.
This is the first movie inspired by Marvel with primarily African-American cast and a black male lead. Luke Cage, another Marvel hero, now a hit series on Netflix. And then Get Out, one of last year's big critical and box office films.
That one's going to win an Oscar.
Well, we're hoping. You're hoping. Let's see. But these were, it was long considered a bad mass market bet, right, to do a black film primarily. And, you know, it makes me wonder, like, have history books, has Hollywood, has publishing, has TV underestimated this appetite for black heroes?
I think Hollywood and culture in general underestimates what black people will spend their money on. There's history of this, right? The blaxploitation movement that started with Melvin Van Peebles and the, you know, the anti-hero pimp movies that came out of the 1960s and 70s. That was, you know, that was a representation that, you know, he takes $10,000 and he makes a movie and then he makes like $500,000 on it. And it's like, oh my God, black people like movies. And so you make movies for black people and you do this. I think they've always done that. And I think now what we're getting to is a real clear representation, positive deposits. You know, if you think about relationship with black people to America, it's a relationship. And you make positive deposits, you make negative deposits. And so if you think if we were like $1,000 in a hole during the slavery, right? So we free the slaves and now we're $500 in a hole. Right. And then you get a little bit of movement. So you get $400 in the hole. But then we go back with Jim Crow's law. So you go back to like $500 in the hole. Then you get to the civil rights movement and you take another big chunk. So you take like $300 out. So now we're $200 in the balance. Right. And then you keep going. And so we're still not at zero yet. And I don't think people realize that that representation, overpopulating movies with positive images of black people, is like fighting a narrative that's been happening for a long time. It's been fighting this idea that black people are this one monolithic thing, as opposed to being, you know, stagecoach drivers and motorcyclists and U.S. Marshals and fighter
war
pilots,
heroes.
War heroes, like looking at us as like not being this monolithic thing that moves in this way, but sort of looking at us as like individuals with a history and a culture in America that's like really entrenched in America. And I think that when you see movies like the Black Panther and people's excitement for it, we finally get to see positive representations of us that are not necessarily built on the magical Negro mythos. You know what I mean? Like the Bagger Vance is sort of a thing. Like not that kind of thing, but like they're people in and of their own right. And I think that sort of says what we've been saying all along. We're here. I think one of the most absurd arguments I've ever heard about black people is like, go back to Africa, you know? And I'm like, my family's been here since Jamestown, right? And your family's been here since Ellis Island. So maybe 100 years, and my family's been here 400 years. But because you've lost your accent and I wear my immigration on my skin, you continue to think that I don't belong here when I just, you know, like we built this place.
What's the balance now that Strange Fruit Volume 2 has come out?
What's the balance? When, you know, when I get little kids who send me letters saying they like the book, you know, or, you know, people come up to me and thank me for drawing the book, I think there's like, those are pennies, I think, off that balance. It's like pennies off that balance. But I think it's all about sharing stories. And I think that sharing stories builds humanity. And I think the more we can share these stories, whether they're stories about black histories or whether they're just personal stories, so that we realize that thing that James Baldwin said about racism doesn't stand up to contact, that's when we get to a place where we rebuild our empathy and our humanity.
Well, Joel, we're going to close with a little more. This is a rendition. There was no recording of Blind Tom Wiggins, but this is the Battle of Manassas. So he obviously is playing with themes like Battle Hymn of the Republic. I think La Marseillaise here.
Well, and I think the thing that's most amazing about that is that I wish there were recordings of Tom, because he didn't just play the songs. He did like musical instruments and explosions and horses, and like he would do this entire rendition. And then every time he would get up after he was finished playing something, as the audience would clap, he would turn and wildly hop around on one foot and clap just like everybody else. He was just like, he was giddy that he had done this.
Joel Christian Gill, giddy to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure.
We're listening to Blind Tom Wiggins. His story is among those featured in Strange Fruit Volume 2 by Joel Christian Gill. And that is a wrap for today. Our show was produced by Jimmy Gutierrez, Taylor Quimby, Hannah McCarthy, and Justine Paradise. Special thanks to the Epsom, Hillsboro, Rochester, Merrimack, Nashua, Kinsley, and Hollis Houses of Pizza. Music today from Poddington Bear, Valella Valella, Blue Dot Sessions, and John Davis there playing the music of Blind Tom Wiggins. Executive producer is Erica Janik. Maureen McMurray is lying on the couch wondering why she just had to eat that extra slice. Remember, we want to hear about your favorite pizza place. Leave us a message with your name, your go-to pie, and why you love it at 603-513-7796. That's 603-513-7796. You can also post your preferred pie on Facebook or on Twitter at Word of Mouth, and we will share your picks on the air. I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth is a production of NHPR.